Good evening, Shalom Aleichem. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg of Star K. Welcome again to our teleconference for Vadim, Rabbanim, and Mashgichim, dealing with kashrus issues from the perspective of the local Vad. Our producer is Reb Zev Steen, who is recording everything. The previous recordings are available at our website, star-k.org. You click on Programs and you'll get to them. This is an ongoing series, and if you'd like to be put on a dedicated list to get our emails with the future dates, send an email to telekosher@star-k.org. We very much like to have participation and to have your comments or questions. And if you have a question at any time, please hit 1-1 on your keypad, and when we recognize you, you'll hear the computer say that you can speak. If the volume is not acceptable, it's too low, press *0 repeatedly, and that should bring it up. We're here in Baltimore, Zev and I, and tonight's speaker, Rabbi Eliezer Eidlitz, is with us by phone from California. Rabbi Eidlitz is well known in the field of kashrus, having written the book Is It Kosher? And keeping many thousands of people informed about kashrus through his website, kosherquest.org, through his email updates, and so on. Rabbi Eidlitz has a very good relationship with the Star K and with Rabbi Heinemann in particular, going back longer than I know about, I think. And on a personal note, when I was in San Jose, many of my Balabatim would go out to Palo Alto for Rabbi Eidlitz's annual pre-Pesach supermarket tour, where he discussed what needs a hechsher, what doesn't need a hechsher, what's changed, and so on. Tonight's topic, recognizing fraud and deception in kashrus, is certainly a timely issue. It just seems that there are more and more stories coming out all the time about fraud, and we hope the Rabbi Eidlitz will give us some insight and direction on the topic. Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi Eidlitz, how are you?
Aleichem Shalom, doing great, and glad to be able to address this topic.
Okay, so what's the first issue that we're going to touch on tonight, Rabbi Eidlitz?
Well, we'll start with there are various levels that I'd like to address: fraud, misrepresentation, and mislabeling, and so on. I'd like to start with the outright fraud, and then we can get into the other ones to follow.
Okay.
In total fraud started about as soon as kashrus started. Of course, the Gemara talks about the halach, the necessity to have a hashgacha on something, to put a siman into meat and so on when transporting it. But in more recent times, in particular in the United States, we have in 1660, when a Jew from Amsterdam, New Amsterdam, got the first license to be able to sell kosher meat, it went from 1660 till 71 without a recorded complaint. But that really isn't as impressive as it sounds, because there were only between 1 and 3,000 Jews in the entire country at the time.
Okay.
In 71, there was already a complaint lodged against the Shochet Moshe in court. The widow Hetty Hayes filed a complaint that she caught that the Shochet was selling non-kosher meat. And that went until 1796, when the government took action that was not a popular action, and that was to revoke his license to sell kosher meat that a person needed at that time.
And where was this again? Which state?
This was in New Amsterdam, and in 1796, mm-hmm. when the first license in the United States was revoked to sell kosher meat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And without that license, he could not sell meat. He stopped. He did stop. It improved a little. Sheiris Israel had a hashgacha at the time, the only hashgacha in the United States, but they found two vendors. This was already now vendors. It wasn't something with the shochet, but the two vendors were distributing meat with false seals, and they falsified the Shevet Israel seals. One happened in 96, and there's another recorded in 1805, and they were fined and, again, not allowed beyond that to sell any kosher meat. Of course, things progressed slowly. In 1813, in general, a shochet was an employee of the kehillah. And other than that, most people made their own food at home. But by 1813, something that is not looked at as a good day in kashrus, the first independent shochet was established, Avram Jacobs, and from then on, it was pretty much every man for himself. And when he wanted to set up shop, said that they're kosher, and then it went to proving that the person really was not at the level that that people wanted. When the amount of shochtim did increase, the Melechus HaKodesh Union was formed in 1863, and they worked very hard to make a kashrus standard, but it was pretty violent. There were a lot of fights that broke out. It wasn't until 1924 when the OU decided to enter a kashrus under Mr. Goldstein, who 10 years later left and started the OK, and that pretty much led to the development of the Big Four with the Star K in 1947 and Chof K in 1969, and today close to 1,000 different, much smaller kashrus agents to try and avoid the fraud and mistakes that that happen in kashrus. The population, on the other hand, went from the 1,000 to 3,000 in the early 1800s. By 1920, there were 3.5 million Jews in the country. So that already made a very strong consumer group, a very viable and visible consumer group that didn't yet know what to do with its power, but it was there and it was forming to a degree. Since it was pre-easy communication, it still wasn't a unified 3.5 million. What was happening in one area certainly wasn't known, even if it was a short distance, but the numbers at least did form.
They were all keeping kosher, the 3.5 million?
Of the 3.5 million, there were many keeping kosher. Mm-hmm. There were about 25% to 30% at the time that were keeping strictly kosher, with a great deal of the others that were in varying degrees. In the East Coast, much more so. West Coast had Denver and Wyoming and San Francisco, a tiny drop in Los Angeles that were keeping kosher, but much more compacted into the small areas of New York, New Jersey, tightly in that area, and eventually into Chicago and Philadelphia on a much smaller basis. And they didn't know how many of the people were keeping kosher. The communication was very weak, but they were there. And they certainly were there. Wasn't yet recognized a great deal by the industry. That didn't happen for a long, long time later. The in more modern times, we have things of once the market grew, and grew by leaps and bounds over the past 20, 30 years, it became something that was very viable to do fraud, do outright fraud. And even as we speak today, it's not 100% clear what the best approach is to avoid that fraud. Today, there are companies, many products, coming most products, have a label on the bottom, basically a disclaimer saying that it could be made on machinery that had peanuts and dairy and fish and any other allergies that they can think of. so that the power of the lawsuit certainly drives the industry and makes them somewhat honest. The power that drives conscious in keeping products kosher hasn't been as much that as the power of the consumer, outright the consumer buying power. The shallot chickens were a major thing in Chicago in 1987, where by the good graces of a Jewish employee of United Poultry and Aspen Foods told the OU to look out and to do a special check when and how to look, and they found that they had an incredible amount of trafe chickens coming over for one of their non-kosher plants going into the shallot chicken. Now, that affected 22 different states. The people had to kosher in 22 different states. That went under, it was sued. That one did go the legal route. And that was sued by the Consumer Protection Division of Illinois. But they didn't sue under the kosher laws. There was a kosher law. Kosher law was pretty decent, but they didn't use that. They were afraid of losing. They were afraid of it being challenged in court as being unconstitutional. So instead, they sued under the Illinois Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Business Act. It was just deceptive business. And, of course, the state won. Shallot paid out close to 300,000 fines at the time, penalties to the OU. That, at the time, those penalties went exclusively to the OU, not to consumers. Consumers were told that they could return the items, and then they could kosher or whatever they could kosher. The Monty chickens won fresh in everyone's mind in September of 06. It was something that people are still shaking over, where the Shabbach meat sold in the Hatzlacha grocery, the non-kosher chickens that he had brought in. That one was a different type of fraud. That was not the person, the actual place where the shechita was. This was pure retail fraud on the distribution level. So here was a distribution that people felt was very good based on it should be good because the person who's the distributor is a very firm person. Turned out that that was highly misplaced. Then we get the other side, the Emes Kosher Gel. For years, there was a company, a Jell-O type of product called Emes Kosher. That one was uncovered.
Emes, like the Hebrew word Emes, right?
Like the Hebrew word Emes, E-M-E-S, Emes Kosher. Emes Kosher was exposed.
Wasn't so Emes.
That it was very far from the Emes. It was ABC's Seventh-day Adventist stores were the ones who really got bothered by it, that they wanted to have only vegetable gelatin. It said it had vegetable gelatin, and it did have some vegetable gelatin. The ingredients list said carrageenan, locust bean gum, plain parv gelatin, unflavored, unsweetened, with hash from Robbie Bronstein. But when Ken Burke, a professor in Loma Linda, tested it, and the Kruger Food Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts tested it, they found that it had 55% meat in it. And the FTC shut them down, although Emes did dispute it, but in the end, they disappeared. That one stopped. Of course, it can go all the way to the McDonald's, the famous McDonald's case, with the lawsuit in 01 and 03, which had nothing to do with us. It shouldn't have anyway. It was no one should ever assume that they can eat fries, although on the West Coast, I definitely for many years, I don't hear as much now, but for many years I heard from people who would say, well, what could be wrong is pure vegetarian, and they use pure vegetable oil, and this logic, of course, goes into many things. But in any case, when Harish Bharti sued the lawyer for the Hindus, that they were advertising all vegetable oil, and it was all vegetable oil. That's all they used in the retail stores. The problem is they had natural flavoring, that deadly word, natural flavoring. Mm-hmm. which was made from beef. So they paid out $10 million properly in this case for consumer education. So
right. Some of that actually came to the Star K. It was given out to some of the agencies. But was that intentional with the McDonald's, or they just didn't know?
McDonald's, it was and it wasn't. It was intentional. They tried to go all vegetable, and the problem is that people were so used to the flavoring, the beef flavoring, the tallow flavoring, that they were losing customers. So they put it back, and they hid it. Anyone who uses this usually is hiding when they're using natural flavor. When people are using that for grape juice and other products, it's often a dodge around the real product, but which they specifically want. There was no doubt that McDonald's wanted natural flavoring. There's no doubt they wanted the natural beef flavoring, and there's no doubt they didn't want to tell people because people were looking for cholesterol and other issues. They felt it was unhealthy. Vegans, vegetarians, Hindus, there were many people who didn't want any of this in their fries. They wouldn't eat the meat, but they would eat the fries. And that, I think, was a very appropriate use of the money because they used it for education.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they told people, go out and learn what really is in products.
Right.
And
why you can't eat at McDonald's if you're kosher.
Although they did say that they were aiming it primarily at others, but they realized somewhat it seems to their surprise that there were Jews who were eating there, that they were not targeting at all. I was once in a chicken place, Petaluma Chickens, in the 80s, and I watched a shochet, shecht. I took a group of people to watch shechita. The shochet was a very knowledgeable person from Europe, learned in Slovotka. He had been in San Francisco way too long, and he shechted alone. He was alone for about 40 years, a shochet there. Unfortunately, when he was done, we counted 6 dead chickens that he shechted, and he was a male as well. So right after the shechita of 1,000 chickens, he yelled out to the Mexican employees, "You know where the box of plumbers are and how to soak and salt it. Make sure you soak and salt everything and then put the plumbers on. I got to go." And he left, and they put the plumbers on. It was quite astounding, aside from the 6 dead chickens that he shechted, that this happened on top of it. So it really was, it can go that far. And that certainly would have been a tough remedy in court, but it did have a remedy of people having knowledge of it and eventually not buying the product, which certainly was a very good thing. And then there are places they do it perhaps inadvertently, perhaps not. Nate's Deli in Palm Springs, every Pesach past 15, 20 years, has their ham on matzah. And but they don't call it kosher. They're calling it kosher style. So at least it's not quite as much of a misrepresentation of that. In Los Angeles, there was a place called Pest Poultry years ago, many years ago. And the Pest Poultry sued the RCC for not allowing the chickens into their supervised stores. So went to court, Italian judge, and this went on for a matter of weeks, cost quite a bit of money. And finally, they did a test. The RCC's contention was they were using hot water for koshering the chickens. So they brought it in, and they brought in the rabbi from Pest Poultry and said, "You agree that it says in the Code of Jewish Law that one cannot use hot water?" They said, "Yes." "Do you agree that in this container it's the heat that you use there?" And he said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, then will you put your arm in it, your elbow in it?" And he said, "Sure." And he did, and they took him from there to the hospital. He of course, scalded himself very severely. And at the end of it, at that point, the judge said, basically, obviously I'm paraphrasing him, I'm just an Italian. What do you guys want out of me and your kosher laws? I can't decide that sort of thing. Go to your court and decide it, which is often something that happens. And that was a true outlook on really what should be.
Mm-hmm. We had a case where a store, an outlet, was buying Starkey cutlets and just repacking them. They weren't under any hashgacha, and writing Starkey on the labels. So it is a fraud because it's not really under hashgacha, but from their perspective, what was wrong?
Right. In that case, it doesn't sound like they intended to defraud. They intended just to make it easier and repackage. But,
right.
Of course, if they weren't knowledgeable enough, they could have been doing things that were very much not the Starkey standards.
Right. Well, I don't think they were even from, so, you know, it would be a Shiloh, Bussish, and Salmon Iron and so on. So we put a stop to that. Let me just interrupt for a second. We're here at the Starkey at our monthly telekosher conference for Bonim and Vadim. We're together with Rabbi Eidlitz from California. If anybody has any questions or you want to pipe in or you want to ask Rabbi Eidlitz or discuss something, hit 1-1 on your keypad and be happy to take your questions. Okay. Let's keep on going, Rabbi Eidlitz.
Well, there is, of course, this goes on. Unfortunately, it's a long list, and most of the list goes on from the past few years. It's increasing.
Is it getting worse?
It is increasing to a degree where people are taking the law. It's become quite profitable to be kosher, and therefore it's somewhat inviting for one to do so and to take the risk. And people take sometimes a calculated risk. Two different restaurants in my area, Avi's Grill, that took over a place that one day was selling chazer, a restaurant, and so on. And the next day, he cleaned it out, bought it, cleaned it out, and put a big sign up, Glock Kosher Meat. And he said that he's going to work on a couple months from now. He hopes to have to contact some rabbi to give him hashgacha. But in the meantime, he knows it's Glock, and therefore it's fine. That person, when I publicized it, sued me in Third Superior Court for a couple of years. And actually put himself out of business because it was so clear what he did was wrong that eventually he closed up and was had to declare bankruptcy. But that's
so he was doing what? He was selling trefa or selling really glot? What?
He was not a Shomer Shabbos person.
And he was just claiming to be glot.
He was claiming the meat was glot, which may or may not have been what he bought, and selling it to the public as such as in a restaurant, in a place that he had never koshered from the tarfus that was there right before, and basically went against most of the norms and accepted basic halachas without any nuances on
kosher. And who defended you in court? Did you have to?
A large firm. I've been defended a few times by some large firms here who do it pro bono, fortunately.
Baruch Hashem. Okay.
Yeah, that has actually worked out. But it goes on. Some intentional, some unintended. The kosher spot in Brooklyn.
Flatbush.
In 05, right? Flatbush was selling, was got non-glot meat as glot. That's something we have today as well. There are many people who think that the meat sold in Trader Joe's, since it's from a major producer who's known for glot, they feel that that is glot David's meat, although it's not. It's clearly not glot, but it doesn't say so on the boxes. It just says the name of the producer. So sometimes there is...
It doesn't say non-glot.
No.
It just has the hashgacha and the brand name.
Uh-huh. It has the hashgacha on it, and it says the name of the processor, who is a major processor of glot kosher meat, and it does not say beyond that that this is different than most of the meat, that this is non-glot. I've had numerous people from around the country call in tears that they've never used non-GLOT meat. I've assured them that this is a kosher non-GLOT meat, but they wouldn't use it. Some are Sfaradim only Beis Yosef, and
right.
would never assume that they're allowed to use this meat. So that is some. So that's more of an of a covert type of a thing. It's not outright fraud, but it is definitely and not clear.
You feel it's misleading.
I feel it's very misleading.
By not writing the non-GLOT.
Right. When someone assumes differently, I think it's very misleading.
Mm-hmm.
Many things that are done. There are many foods like that. We've got, of course, dairy products that are like that. Many non-dairy products that are called non-dairy and have a milk derivative in it.
Right. So in case you need... like the creamers you're talking about, maybe.
The creamers and numerous others, the non-dairy creamers,
right.
some of the other products.
But that's a law. That's a law. The law says you have to write non-dairy because it's not milk-based.
Right.
What's that?
Since it doesn't contain actual
right.
Dairy, so therefore they'd be bragging that they have dairy. But on the other hand, of course, they're... The New England Medical Journal had a few years ago, there were 6 people almost died from those products because it did have, and they were hyperallergic to dairy.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a quirk in the law. It's like a quirk in the law.
It's something that I've argued with the head of the FDA for many years. And
who was that?
It never resulted. Gene Newberry.
Okay.
Gene Newberry. It's someone who I know well. We discuss many food products, but this one we have not come to an agreement on. Is it she?
So she says that they have to write...
It's a he.
So he says you have to... He doesn't agree that the non-dairy is misleading. Because I know from experience that that's a big... People oftentimes make a mistake with that.
And from what people call up, most definitely is an issue. I mean, we have, though, in the industry, in the regular and our own, having liver and heart and different parts put inside a whole chicken in a plastic, where Misha has a major chuva about how it'll trafe it up, and the plastic doesn't help. Is only put there, 99% of people throw it away. It's put there to be able to gain weight when a person sells it. It's not put there for anything else. There is no sign on the package that says trace meat inside. You have to kosher it.
You're talking about the liver? The liver?
The liver, right. There's liver.
When they put the liver inside?
They put the liver in the plastic and
mm-hmm.
inside... And when people are making a whole chicken, a whole
right.
duck, and so on, they find out later on, and this becomes a
right.
very, very hard thing to weigh and with displacement to find out if there was bittle, hoping
right.
there were other things. But
the store that we have here, they do write on the outer package that there is a liver inside and that it needs to be broiled, and people still make a mistake.
It would have to be. I haven't... From the amount, again, the people who have emailed and called, I would have to say that it's not working. It's got to be a lot better than that to be able to make it work. It's just not really working. The attempt to curb a number of these things, there was Comex self-service meets and Tammy Brook Country Club there and the Catskills, there are in Quest Colorado, there are a whole bunch of different things that the government has tried to do. That doesn't seem to go too well. First of all, their fines are a joke. Their fines are very, very minimal. They can be $100, $300. It's just such a small amount that it's worth their taking the risk.
Well, that's why sometimes if the government comes from the point of view of consumer protection, those laws are sometimes stronger.
Those, absolutely. And those laws are not controversial. And those are, let's say here, when the governor, previous governor of California, Gray Davis, made a halal law in 2002, that was coupled with the regular law. 383B, State California Penal Code, is part of the general fraud law. It's not a new kosher law and seems to stand up pretty well when it comes to when it's part of those, it does, because that already can contain jail sentences. And that obviously is daunting somewhat to people. The bigger thing I think that we have, these are spectacular cases, interesting cases, but they're not really the common cases. It's more when it comes about, it really shakes us up. And what we're having a lot more is what we see daily from the Star K alert, from the list I send out, and others. We see that almost daily there are products that are mislabeled, and people are unaware of how exactly to read or what to make of something. Confusion that one run is kosher, one run is treif. We have many products that have special runs that are kosher, or that one part of the run, one part of the production of one type is kosher, another not. That more will confuse people. And I think the remedy to both is the same. The fact that today the major responsible kosher agencies are putting out that information to consumers, the fact that the Star K has such a thing like this, the fact that there's so much work in educating people into the right thing and including people, that's what really does it, because that makes or breaks a market on whether they will survive or not. And that's where I see a great deal of good happening. Years ago, compared to the amount of kosher products, there was so much more fraud. Today, with everything exploding, the amount of kosher products we have, but the amount of fraud hasn't gone up. That has stayed pretty much static. Again, in 98, New York had 392 kosher investigations, 105 violations. In 01, they had 97 violations. By now, 10 years after, there's so many more kosher products, and yet the amount of violations were less than that.
That could be a function of how much the investigator is focusing on those issues, or, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's less problems.
It doesn't. It definitely doesn't. But on the other hand, when any of these scandals happen now, with the internet, with phones, with emails, it goes out within minutes,
right,
within hours. The entire world knows about it. The entire world is talks immediately about that. There is no hiding anymore. There is
right.
No just one area. There's no longer a disconnect between Kansas, California, and New York. All know at the same time, and we'll find
right,
out very,
true.
Very quickly.
But with what you're saying, there also is an obligation on the consumers and the Balbatim, because I had somebody once asked me, he said, can I just rely on the Star K or the OU and just go into a store and just buy and not have to worry about anything else? If I see the Star K or the OU or whatever hechsher it is, then I know that it's okay and I don't have to be an informed consumer. I said, absolutely not. You have to follow the news. You have to look at the information and read the get the alerts and you know, sometimes there are shilas and you have to ask your rav, and it's impossible. I think you would definitely agree. It's impossible to be just go in the dark and rely on the symbol.
I was with my wife shopping in a large store once. She was shopping for clothing. She looked at a sweater and she took it off the rack and looked at it and turned it around. I asked her, what is she looking at? She said, well, sometimes it's irregular. Sometimes there's a run. Sometimes, as a consumer, she wasn't relying on the label. She knew that's a good start. And from there, she knew she had to check. We certainly, in something more important like kosher, have to do that and have to be informed and have to know what we're looking for. And obviously, when people see things that are too good to be true, it's really ridiculous for them to assume that it can be. There are still those thousands other small companies. The large ones are doing an incredible job. Are the other ones that unfortunately are not always doing that? There's a nice-looking K, a roundish sort of K, circle around it. which has on the Libby's and the Dole mixed fruit, the fruit cocktail, it says right in it that it contains carmine. It's very clear that that rabbi feels the carmine from the cochineal insects is fine. Or if one got, as one consumer did a while back, and they got in their office Charles chips, potato chips, and they sent to me a copy, says a pizza flavored potato chips with a large OUD, and it is certified by the OUD. The only difficulty is that the last ingredients read partial hydrogenated soybean oil, extractives of paprika, bacon fat, natural smoke flavor. And when I emailed to the OU and asked, is the bacon fat glot, they weren't overly pleased with me, but they, of course, they did a wonderful job of researching it. In a very short time, they found that what happened, someone had stolen OU stationery. They whited out what was there from a different certificate, wrote it. They didn't know enough that bacon fat shouldn't be on the listing. They put the true listing. They were afraid of the government for that and market. But within a few days, you couldn't find it in the country. It was recalled in a very, very strong way. And that's where I'm a major fan of the large cautious agencies. I don't see it possible anymore for a serious product to be handled by someone in their place, one person, two people. It takes a group of people. It takes the checking. It takes sometimes the laboratory testing. It takes many different things to be able to give a proper hashgacha. And today, that's where our protection is, not the government. And it is the hashgacha agencies that are reliable, that are putting in the professional hard work, and then disseminating when there was a problem in a particular dance. And that's where, as a partnership between the agencies and the consumers, that works. That works really, really well. When people bemoan the fact, oh, no, it's been struck down a certain law, different state laws and so on, that's not, with the best of laws, are not really what will help us.
That's a good point. We're speaking with Rabbi Eliezer Eidlitz in California. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg from Star K. And if you have any questions or you want to join in, hit 1-1 on your keypad. Do you remember the case, Rabbi Eidlitz? There was a Tyson chicken being sold, I think, at Costco with an OU.
Yes.
You remember that? So the OU was in the back on, I think it was part of the date code. So
that's exactly what it was, and that wasn't even,
right.
That was very much not intentional.
Right.
And that sometimes you have. I have in front of me a manual for Casio watches, Casio model 642 watches. On the left is a prominent OU.
No, right. There
that's
you go.
That's what they use for the UK. This was one for the
OU is moving into electronics now. They're going to compete with our Hechsher on the ovens.
Perhaps they wanted.
Does it have the Sabbath mode on the dead watch?
If it helped, that's a wonderful thing. And often you get where companies really don't understand what they're doing, and they need a lot of explanation. It's a lactate they picked up in Lakewood, the lactate 70 milk produced
right.
Locally, has an OUD on top and a K underneath. So I asked the company, why did you need a K when you already have a recognized symbol? And they said, well, nobody knows what that means, but everybody knows a K means kosher. Mm-hmm. So they contacted another rabbi who was willing to give them a K. And that, they were sure everyone would know now, was truly kosher. And even just following products, there's a Nescafe that is kosher la Pesach. It has, this one is under the OU, and it's kosher Pesach, Parv, It's written in Hebrew and English underneath, and it's sold in Eretz Yisrael. It's manufactured in Glendale, California, exported to Petah Tikva, Israel, imported by Canada, and that's the only place where it's legal to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, so just following with the trail, it's a major thing that people that goes through conscious today, and one needs to be able to be on top of that. You have there's an email where someone sent to me a question. My wife's sister and husband keep kosher, so we have a special pot for their visit. Recently, my wife caught me using the pot for my tray suit. She insists we must buy another pot, but I say as long as my in-laws believe it's kosher, they won't violate their faith by using it. Would I be unethical to keep this secret or simply cheat? Someone from Montclair, New Jersey. So people definitely are not really sure. Again, this is the point where there's a lot of education that needs to go into this to be able to do it. I have an email of someone, a company, a large company, wanted to know what colors are kosher to be able to print on the kosher packaging and what there is. This person really needed help.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if granola and oats are Pesach dick. They don't even say
right.
kosher for Passover.
Right.
They are Pesach dick.
Right.
So,
right.
There's a
right.
fair amount of education that we need out there.
Well, let me ask you something on a different topic, about it. From a point of view of a VOD in whatever city it is across the United States, they're trying to prevent fraud, deception in let's say a restaurant might be the most common example. What advice would you have for them? In a nutshell, what would you say they should look for, and what should they focus on, and how to go about making sure they don't get defrauded?
Well,
especially since the quality necessarily of the mashgichim they have may not be that great, and the resources, they don't have a whole staff of 10 or 20 or 30 people working for them.
I think transparency. Any good hashgacha will allow a certain amount of transparency. They will allow someone else to come in a non-intrusive fashion, and they will make sure that they are clear of their policies, which is something in general that would be a wonderful thing. Let's say there's someone in New York, a rabbi, who feels that it's okay to use cheese that is not made by yet hard cheese. As long as the ingredients are kosher, it's fine. Fish without fish fillet is fine because one can use a microscope to see it. And the fact that the Shulchan Aruch says differently, he says, he disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch. At least this is what he's expressed to me in his lawsuit. Now, that person, at least has made his policies quite clear. And one can say, well, is this a recommended hashgacha or not? Clearly, I don't recommend it. I side with the Shulchan Aruch. The more information that's there helps one make a clear decision. And they're armed with that information. And today, this is a country of information. The more that's out there, the better. Obviously, on packages, sometimes it can be somewhat misleading. We have, let's say, again, going to the OU on their French's, Liam Perrins and French's
right.
Worcestershire sauce.
That's the
one
OU fish.
One doesn't.
Right.
The one without French's is because it's butthole, it's a smaller amount.
Right.
On the other hand, people who follow the Chabad way of desire don't really want to use it because the zayar must be even under bittel. So that's not halacha, and certainly it's correct in doing it. But in this case, again, consumers need to understand that's the standard of identity. It's probably going to be there, and therefore they need to read the ingredients and to know what to look for, what is and what is not acceptable to whatever they want. Something that's not Holy Soul may be acceptable to some and not to others, and that is, again, it's the part that I'm somewhat often mystified by is very few people will go to a doctor without recommendation. Very few people will have be operated upon by someone who does not have a true knowledge and capability of what they're doing. Conscious definitely deserves as much. Our neshama deserves the same type of care, and people and organizations that do have that capability and not just that they basically know somewhat how to do it.
Let me ask you a question. Would you intrigue me with your cases of the lawsuits that have come against you? I assume most of these cases are because you identified some fraud or something that was not 100% kosher, and you exposed it, and then they turned against you. That's what it sounded like from your description.
Yeah, everyone.
Tell us some more of those cases. They sound, you know, it sounds like you. I never realized that you were in that position of having to defend yourself.
I often in that position, but some of them are still ongoing, so I'm not really sure that they're a good idea to.
Your lawyer won't allow you to talk about it.
I do stick to the recommended and not recommended to keep myself relatively free from burdening the lawyers. But
you mean if somebody calls you about a certain hashgacha, you'll say
recommended or not?
You don't say it's kosher or it's not kosher, because who knows if it's really not kosher? It can't be guaranteed to be not kosher. You don't recommend it.
And it certainly may be kosher according to some to some standards. If the person is using a non-kosher grape juice in their natural flavoring, but they feel that that's okay to use because there was a gairim, or maybe they feel that it's okay to use it because it was still on the shmarim when they were mevashalit, and the standard is to cook it more, or if someone feels that their oils become bottle and not to worry about it since they're bottle since the first of the law is the first 300 gallons of switchover oil has to be used for pet food, so therefore they're relying on the shita that one can kosher with a different, with oils even, and with meperis. So it's hard to call these things they're not kosher according to the accepted standard. They're far from kosher according to a star K standard, but they are. There is a standard that may do it. In a court of law, kosher so far has been said to be by the Orthodox standard. However, that's getting pretty weak. That is still getting pretty weak and hard to rely on for. But having consumer information is always legal.
We have changed a little bit. We used to use a not recommended statement. We started saying that if they ask us about a product that or a hechsher that we don't approve of, we say Starcade doesn't use it.
No.
Meaning we don't use it in our facility. So nobody could have any claim on that because we're not even saying anything about it. It's just that we don't use it. We're not even directing you to use it or not to use it. The assumption is if you're calling us, you want to know what we're doing, so then we say We don't use it. And most people understand that what we're trying to get at, and they shouldn't use it either. And so that takes us even a little bit more away from the legality issues, so we don't end up in court.
I would rather, I receive usually about 1,000 emails a week, and many of the people are in locales where they just need an answer. I'm afraid they may not understand me well.
Mm-hmm.
So I just I take that chance.
Right.
When
a
product Tofu Life, these just threatened to sue, but then they stopped existence. Tofu Life is a product with a very pretty Hufke Parv on it, with a rather large asterisk on the top sides of the Huff. And
okay.
When you look at the ingredients, it says kosher pending. So I was rather intrigued, and I asked them, what does kosher pending mean? And they said kosher pending means that they really, as soon as they can, when sometime soon they are going to contact a rabbi to see what it takes to make a kosher. But they didn't have time. They had to print the printers, or they had to print. So they printed with the hashgacha, and the chafke looked like a nice symbol.
The chafke was they used the actual chafke?
They used a beautiful chafke. It's a very large.
So you think that the chafke would go after them?
The chafke did. When I sent it to the chafke sent to them a letter right away, very professionally and very clear, and that did take care of it. When I send thousands of letters to companies, sometimes the companies send back just a whole packet. One company sent from a well-known hashgacha that many don't use. The gist of it is, can we put your hashgacha, your kosher symbol on the product? And he said, certainly you can put it on, and I hope to be sometime soon to visit your plant. And at that point, you can explain to me further what goes into the product.
Right, okay. It's an email hashgacha.
That was an email hashgacha, and there is, it was a very large, that's a very large hashgacha.
Right. That's why we don't use it. Right.
That is what it had.
Right.
If one goes that way, it might as well go someone mailed to me that they bought on the internet a different hashgacha. Might as well use that one. It's the KATM. The KATM, at least, was legitimate.
KATM?
KATM. It's a Mexican symbol and hashgacha. It's kosher according to me. It takes stickers and puts it on a product and says, fine, that's kosher according to me. At least that's honest in what he's doing.
All right, Rabbi, so we appreciate your time, and looks like we had a group joining us, but everybody's quiet. If anybody wants to get in touch with you at some point, how do we reach you?
Either at online, which is the best, at kosherquest at EEIDLITZ at kosherquest.org, or they can call me 818-262-5351.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Eilitz. It was very enlightening and enjoyable. And I want to mention that this conference is a regular occurrence. And if you want to be apprised of the next speaker, please send us an email at telekosher@star-k.org. Thank you again, Rabbi Eilitz. Kol tov.
My pleasure.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.